I turned 18 in fall 1941 and had to do military service. To avoid it, I would have had to go abroad, but that wasn't possible. You needed money to leave the country, and we hadn't any. Today people ask, why didn't you emigrate? But it wasn't so easy. My father said when they draft you, you have to obey. Desertion would mean certain death. Just don't become an officer, don't assume any responsibility. That was his position, non-participation and hoping it would end. High school graduates, of course all voluntarily, became officer cadets. No one asked, one was simply pushed in that direction. It wasn't easy to avoid being lined up like that. I had to use all kinds of tricks to stay in the lowest ranks. After 3 years, I was a lance corporal and had to guard railroad stations or ride on trains as a guard. Lance corporals were reputed to be dumb and only good for guard duty. From the start, I was intentionally one of the despised shirkers. After the war, when one heard who all had fallen, hardly any of my school friends returned, I naturally looked back on this with some misgiving. But at the time, one had to decide, and playing the game wasn't an option for me. I just did whatever was necessary to make sure that at the next medical, it came around every 6 months, I was passed fit for garrison duty and not for service at the front. At one point, I really had mild tuberculosis, so I helped it along a bit. I asked a doctor friend for advice and he said, when you're standing there naked in front of the troop doctor, how does he diagnose a lung infection? You have a temperature and you look awful. Right, we'll fix it. He said I should inject myself with skimmed milk 4 hours before the examination, and he gave me powdered copper vitriol, which I was to dissolve in water and drink. The skimmed milk would raise my temperature, and the powder would make me feel nauseous. It was midsummer, there were no fridges. By the time I had to inject the milk in the night, it had gone sour. I filled the syringe all the same and pumped it into my thigh. 2 or 3 hours later, I didn't just have a slight temperature, I didn't have a thermometer, I had high fever, I was literally burning up. Then I put the copper vitriol in water, stirred it, it was a fabulous light green solution, and was about to pour it down my throat. I had a few drops on my lips and tongue, and I began puking. Copper vitriol is a pretty nasty poison, but it doesn't kill you because you can't get it down. So I was emptied out and felt awful. In the morning, I appeared before the military doctor and stood naked in line with the others. There was a big red bruise on my thigh where I'd given myself the injection. I tried to conceal it with my hand. Either the doctor didn't notice it or he didn't want to notice it. At any rate, he checked me quickly and then said, "Yes, you still have the symptoms, you're still a risk. Go and take care of yourself." I learned of the attempted coup of July 20, 1944 on the radio at the station guardhouse in Freising. It sent the blood to my head. I sensed what lay behind it. If Klaus Schenk Graf von Stauffenberg's attempt on Hitler's life had been successful, I don't think Göring or Goebbels would have taken over. I feel sure that the government would have fallen into the hands of the resistance because the military had sworn an oath of allegiance to Hitler alone. Freed by Hitler's death of the duty to obey, the military would have joined the resistance leaders. Because of their high rank, the resistance leaders enjoyed authority in the Wehrmacht, the German armed forces, and as a result of Operation Valkyrie, they were already in possession of the major instruments of power. Of that I'm convinced. I was a clerk on the staff of my unit. A message came through from the Supreme Command of the Armed Forces. It was stamped military secret and contained a list of measures to be applied under the codename Valkyrie in case of civil unrest. It officially passed through my hands as clerk. I read it and I was surprised by the formulation civil unrest. When I heard the announcement on the radio, I realized what it meant. The longed-for putsch had failed. But in the meantime, I know that far more was going on Bavaria on July 20th than ever came out. Far more people were involved than the SS and Gestapo actually held responsible. There were tanks, for instance, in Freising. On July 20th, they rolled out toward Munich, and after the attempt against Hitler had failed, they rolled back home again without event. Later, they called it a field duty exercise. But then Major Braun, he had been in command of these tanks, played a key role 9 months later in the Bavarian Freedom Action. Before July 20th, there had been an extensive network of sympathizers throughout Bavaria, but so loosely knit that the moment things went wrong at the top, it fell apart, so there were no traces to follow up. At the end of 1944, the Bavarian Freedom Action formed up from these elements, although it was only in 1945 that it became really active. Toward the end of the war, my sister was conscripted to work as a secretary in a university medical institute that had been moved out to near Freising. At the time, I was part of the guard unit at Freising Station. Through my sister, I got to know Leo Heuving. He belonged to the interpreter's company, and I soon trusted him implicitly. Now I became involved, if only at the periphery, with the Bavarian Freedom Action. On Leo Heuving's instructions, I was to ride the number 3 tram from Arnulfstraße to Steubenplatz in Munich. "There'll be a captain standing at the tram stop," he said, "with such and such insignia, Bamberg cavalry, etc., wearing a little beard. Sit next to him on the tram." So I did my salute, hand to cap and so forth. Later, I learned he was Ruprecht Gerngross, captain of the interpreter's company. So there I was, sitting next to him in the tram, which thank heavens was empty, and he asked me about the officers in my unit, whether there was any chance of recruiting them. He said there were plans to surrender the city of Munich to the Allies without a struggle. He was completely open with me. Sadly, there was only one man I could name who wouldn't instantly betray us, but I couldn't really recommend even him as a partner. My information disappointed Gerngross. He got off at Steubenplatz and we never saw each other again. So I had this kind of contact with the Bavarian Freedom Action. Then on April 27, 1945, soldiers of the Interpreter's Company occupied the German Armed Forces headquarters in Munich and Starnberg. Gerngross and others had captured the radio stations in Erding and Freimann, and we're now broadcasting Europe-wide the fall of the Nazi regime in Munich. He called for the pheasant hunt to begin, the hunt for the gold pheasant, the gold-braided party functionaries. It was a call for revolt and resistance against the Nazis. An SS division advanced to liberate the stations, and the soldiers left one by one. Some survived. They hid in haystacks on farms or in the canal system at Erdinger Moos. The SS used search dogs. A lot of men lost their lives in this operation just before the end of the war. At this time, I was doing guard duty in a barracks in Blutenburgstraße. In the guard room, I heard Captain Gerngross speaking on the radio of the Bavarian Freedom Action. Everyone was listening to his speech, rapt, eyes agape. You could see what people were thinking, but no one dared to say anything. Everyone just wanted to get back home as soon as possible. It was obvious the war was lost. I decided to go to our captain's office to tell him I had connections with the Bavarian Freedom Action and that he should call Captain Gerngross of the Interpreter's Company and put our unit at his disposal. I was 21 and completely naive. On the way up to his office on the first floor, I passed the master sergeant's office and heard the radio through the door. This time it was the voice of Gauleiter Giesler yelling the name Gerngross. And then the master sergeant yelled, "They should all be strung up." I turned on my heel and went back to the guard room.